Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, February 19, 2011. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and we are beginning live. We're weekly, you know, from 3 to 4 Eastern Time from the United States. And I would like to first welcome our guests, which are located in several places in Stockholm, Sweden. We're very glad to welcome Hussein Askari. Welcome.
Thanks a lot, Mary.
Good. That sounds like a good connection. Hussein is the Arabic language editor for Executive Intelligence Review and EIR Online. And I'll point out some of his articles, but really they're in the latest February 18 edition, the latest post of EIR Online. But we're very glad to welcome from Baltimore Lawrence Freeman. Welcome, Larry.
Glad to be with you, Marcia.
Good. Likewise, good connection. And in the same issue I mentioned of EIR Online, the latest posted one, you'll find articles from Larry reporting on his recent trip of some 10 days in Sudan, in which he spent 2 days in Darfur. We'll hear from him on that. And I will say just at the beginning of this program that Hussein Askari has some time constraints, and we're looking forward to hearing from him for the first half hour, and also questions or comments from Larry then. But then the second half hour, we will turn to Larry for that time. Now, our topic, you will have seen on LaRouchePub.com, is that it's not just an Egypt crisis. That is, it's not just a, in quotes, or so-called Egypt crisis. And the solution is a global Glass-Steagall. And I want to extend that by way of introduction to just say you could say it's not just a Tunisia crisis or a Yemen crisis or Iran, or even now you could say it's, nor is it merely a Wisconsin crisis, Ohio crisis in the United States. The point is we're in a worldwide phase of decline that's at a collapse stage. And while there are different particulars, certainly for nations, for states, for cities, there are very common global features to all of this. To mention just a few, there is a worldwide food crisis. There's a shortfall of actual volumes of food and capacity for it, and there is wild out of control. Well, you can't control speculation. You shouldn't have it, but the speculation is going wild. It's not just a coincidence of droughts or something like that behind the world food crisis. Another feature of the global situation, you could call it a crisis for youth, that millions of youth are told there's no future, there's no need for you to hang around, it's over. This is insanity. We can get to that in a minute. But again, back to the point, we're in an end phase of a breakdown that's been going on for over 3-4 decades, where we've had a monetary system that was looting and ruining things in the world it was really a neo-British empire of what's definitively a British empire. You had stinking personal corruption, manipulation of divisions among people between religions or tribes or nations, fights over resources. And you had the insertion and placement of traitors and subversives in different key governments, and that brings us around to the United States. And all of this I've just described is not a flaw of the system we've had internationally in the last 40 years. It's been the nature of a neo-British Empire system through the Inter-Alpha, as it's called itself since 1971, banking networks, that kind of thing. But as I say, all of this brings us around to the United States, and the person occupying the presidency, Barack Obama, who's unfit because he is an agent of this imperialistic crowd. And so really it confronts all of us here in the United States mostly. A lot of our listenership, of course, is based here, not confined here, but we have a lot of Americans listening to this particular program, and we have to confront that by allowing this person to remain in the presidency, Obama to remain in office and not removing him, and we have the means through the constitutional orderly process spelled out in Amendment 25, Section 4, you can remove someone unfit for office. We are allowing the misery and the desperation to go on internationally. So that defines our task, doesn't it? To do everything to move him aside and make way for restoring an American system, historically connected credit and development financial system, not this monetarist British thing. And we can do that through Glass-Steagall, the 1933 law that needs reinstated. We can, and then back to what I was saying at the beginning about it's not an Egypt crisis or a Wisconsin crisis. We can rightly view today's uprisings around the world as a great opportunity this year, instead of some end phase disaster. And that's the point. Helga Zepp-LaRouche has an international feature. I refer you again to EIR Online, where Larry and Hussein's reports from Africa and Egypt and Sudan are. And she says, look, the point is we can have an historic opportunity of 2011. So with that, I just would like to turn things over to Hussein Askari to open the discussion, to lay out whatever you wish about Egypt itself from that vantage point, or about other situations in the larger world, in North Africa, Southwest Asia, as you wish. Please go ahead, Hussein.
Yes, thank you. Well, it's not Egypt in itself. The thing is, you know, people ask me, say, you are a Southwest Asia expert or whatever. That's not what I am doing. What I have been doing, actually, has been looking and studying what Lyndon LaRouche has been saying in the past 15, 16 years, and looking around me around the world, and also where I, you know, specifically study in terms of the political situation. I report in Southwest Asia, North Africa. I see that what LaRouche has been saying is, you know, right to the point. I mean, Lyndon LaRouche has been saying for many years, especially since 2007, July 2007, that we have reached the final phase of the collapse of the post-Bretton Woods system, the system of globalization, and, you know, with special emphasis on the word global, and that this final phase of the global breakdown crisis is going to bring with it the collapse of the real economy of nations, social crises, food crises, and so on and so forth. And the longer leaders in Europe and the United States do not implement the policies which LaRouche has proposed, is by going back to the policies implemented by Franklin Roosevelt and later, about 2-3 years, the Black-Steagall policy to stop this global casino and go back to a productive credit policy to save the world's physical economy, producing enough food for nations, producing enough infrastructure to make society function, healthcare, scientific research, and so on and so forth, that as long as these steps are not going to be taken, that we will be stepping one closer to the abyss, to a dark age. Now, when LaRouche was saying these things 3 years ago, 2 years ago, 1 year ago, this looked like something which could happen in the future. But LaRouche has been saying that this is what have been happening for 40 years, but we have reached the final phase of the global breakdown process. So this is really the issue, is that what you're going to do about the global economic financial system is what's going to determine what will happen in Egypt, in North Africa, and Africa, and South America, because wherever you step now, from Wisconsin to Mexico to South America to Africa, Eastern Europe, and even nations in Europe, you have exactly the same problem, but it manifests itself in different ways, because in each area, each nation has its also specific social, economic, historical, and cultural differences. But all these are part of the breakdown crisis Lyndon LaRouche has been talking about. So this is where we have to start the discussion. Now, as you mentioned, that Helga Zepp-LaRouche said recently after that President Mubarak of Egypt resigned, that we have a great moment. We have an opportunity. It's not because that the people who are revolting against the misery, you know, caused by 40 years of this British free trade and globalization, that those people have any idea or a plan what to do next. But because a great lie, the big lie about the economy, the globalization, the free trade, is exposed now. Nobody can believe it anymore. No matter how many speeches Obama reads off the teleprompter about the economic recovery, that lie is exposed now. So this situation opens for us the door to great possibilities, but also to great dangers if people don't take the ideas presented by Lyndon LaRouche seriously now. So we made the opportunity is from the fact that, like in psychiatry, the first step is to realize that you are sick and accept the fact that you are sick before you can be treated. So denial is gone, not denial, but the denial of the reality of the crisis.
Yeah.
So now that we have a possibility that to step into a new situation and say, well, not only were warned about this crisis, but now you have the solutions already present. And you look at the work which is being done by the LaRouche Pack, like the video which was produced 2 days ago about the hope for Africa, from the standpoint of LaRouche's economics, the helping of the biosphere. Now, this is great hope for Africa. But that is the only source for the hope is from the LaRouche movement, from Lyndon LaRouche's ideas, but that they should be taken into the policy of the United States and European nations especially. So that's where the real issue is. Now, you talk about North Africa, that this situation is more explosive there. And we started with Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya. You have Bahrain, all these guys. So the people there hate their leaders, and they're attacking the immediate people who have been implementing the policies of the IMF, and they have been oppressing them politically to swallow this terrible policy, swallowing the bitter medicine of austerity. This is exactly what Obama is calling, making hard decisions. Hard decisions like what? Well, you have to accept poverty and fascist austerity to resolve this financial crisis. And these leaders in the region, like Obama and the U.S. Congress, are saying that they're telling people, like in Egypt, about the poverty, that this was God's will, trying to convince the poor that it's God's will that you are poor. In the U.S., of course, they don't say that it's God's will, but they say it's the market. You can't do anything about it. It's the market which decides. So you are not supposed to go against God or the market. So the food crisis, which we have now global in the region, they say because it's the problem, it's not that the people realize that this is a result of the global hyperinflationary policy, which Obama's bailout policy is and the European Central Bank bailout policy is contributing to. But people are told that it's because of the rainfall. And whose will is the rainfall? It's God's will. So you have in the West, you have the market, the speculators and the cartels decide the food prices. But these are like gods, are not touchable. You are not supposed to stop them. You are not supposed to put them under control, under the power of government. So we have now both societies in Europe, the United States, but also in North Africa and the Arab world, people believe in superstition. Whether it's the market forces or God's will or whatever, this is full of superstition, and this is, of course, takes you one step closer to a dark age. So, but the question is, when it comes about these nations, as I said, each nation, each region had specific characteristics, and common features like what you have in North Africa and the Middle East or Southwest Asia. What is common among these nations is, for example, they have been part, actually, of the IMF World Bank policies, which have been imposed by the British and the United States on these nations, like free trade zones, the looting of their raw materials, including the agricultural production of these nations, denial of nuclear technology and other technologies for these nations. All these nations have these common features. These were former British and French colonies, and unfortunately still tied to the British and French and other European colonizers politically and economically today. These countries were convenient dictatorships, you know, which if somebody asks if these are dictatorships, yes, they were dictatorships, but these were convenient dictatorships for Europe and the United States. They were a buffer zone, formerly against communism, now against Islamic fanaticism, especially after 9/11. I mean, there are many, many examples one could give, but maybe you can take it later about why these dictatorships have been convenient, and only now, last 3-4 weeks, in Europe and the United States and the media, they are being called by that name. That is a long story, but what's also common among these nations is the fact that these are all adjacent to the desert, mm-hmm. the Sahara, and also the deserts in the Middle East. And that's really the when people talk about solutions, this is what we have to think about, as it was shown in the LaRouche-Pack video last 2 days, Pope of Africa, very beautifully, that these nations are all are affected by the expansion of the desert, the lack of water resources, and as I said, they were denied nuclear power and other technologies to desalinate seawater or even move water from large rivers to the desert areas to grow food, especially. Now, what is common among these nations that collectively, Morocco, Algeria, Tunis, Libya, Egypt, and other countries, they are the world's largest importers of wheat, for example, and other basic foodstuff. These nations collectively, they take 30% of the whole globe's wheat exports. And these nations have a deficit of wheat and other basic food for about 50% of their needs. So these nations are, you know, being denied the possibilities, have been denied the possibilities to grow their own food because of the free trade policy and the Malthusian anti-technological development policies. So these are all common features among these nations, but they have been kept under tight control, and also because these nations played geopolitical, a role in the British geopolitical games, like, for example, Bahrain.
Yes.
You have Bahrain is a little country, it's an island, but there you have the largest U.S. Marine base in the whole region. You have Qatar, which is also the base for the largest American and British Air Force bases in the region, from which Iraq was invaded and from which maybe Iran will be targeted. The United Arab Emirates, there were never any elections in the United Arab Emirates. There is no parliament. But it's an offshore bank, an offshore British bank, and it's a center for money laundering for Afghan opium, which is also controlled by the British. Saudi Arabia is part of this Anglo-Saudi oil and terrorism axis, which has been used to control not only the region, but also international politics. So you have all these characters of these nations that have the situation for 30 years have been allowed to continue as it is under the dictatorship rule because this dictatorship was convenient for the Anglo-American policy and the policies of globalization and free trade. So that's where you have, it's not simply these nations' own policies, which is the problem, is that the policies have been global policies, and they have been implementing these policies. Just one little example mm-hmm. on Egypt and Mubarak. Now, a few years ago, after 9/11, from here, from Sweden, which people think, you know, the politicians here are angels, two Egyptian citizens were arrested, former Islamists, have been here as political refugees, and they were kidnapped or arrested by police. They're taken to the closest airport and shipped abroad the infamous CIA, private jets, which people know that they were taking people from all around the world, suspected terrorists. And they were flown to Egypt, where they were tortured almost to death. Now, Egypt is known, besides the pyramids, and the great quality cotton, is that's also known for effective torture methods. Mm-hmm. Now, this was done during the Cheney-Bush era. But who is the author of the policy? Here in Sweden, either the foreign minister or the interior minister was supposed to accept the decision that these two people will be kidnapped by police here and taken to the CIA airplanes. Was it Mubarak was the author of this policy, or was he just the end side of the whole policy? So you have this as an example of, you have a global policy, but Mubarak was implementing a global policy. He was told to do this. But people in these regions, they hate their leaders because they did implement this policy. But the author of the policy is coming from above, and it is from the transatlantic financial empire with its center in London and with lackeys in Wall Street and in Washington. And that's what has to be changed. That's where we have to start changing things. And with Obama staying in the White House, there is very little chance to get these changes. But it is still possible. We are presented with a historic opportunity, but it can also turn into some sort of a French Revolution, where people's demands for economic justice will be met by martial laws, as in Egypt, actually, after the celebrations of the Mubarak stepping down and so on and changing the government. Now you have a military government in Egypt, and the same youth who were saying that we want our political rights now, immediately, some of them, the days after the political demonstrations, you had the labor unions and the poor people coming out and protesting and say, we want economic justice. And the same people who are saying we want political changes today, not tomorrow, now they're telling those people, well, you have to wait. These things take time. And the military supreme command in Egypt, which has taken over power, has ordered people, saying that the demonstrations and demands by these labor unions and poor people are destroying our economy. These will not be allowed. So you have a shift immediately from people saying, we want political freedom, but when the question of economic freedom comes up and economic justice for people who have been crushed for 30 years, now suddenly they are not allowed to protest. So suddenly you have a move from great hope into a real, practically military dictatorship. And that can reignite the whole situation. And instead of in the Tahrir Square, instead of celebrations and tents, we might have the guillotine being raised there.
Right. Well, you present a clear picture. Larry, you may have questions, too, because of which jump in with him if you wish, because Hussein has time constraints. But may I ask you one thing more immediately, Hussein? One thing we're making, the one situation in the United States is, in recent weeks, we've had this report released put out by the federal agency called the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, often known by its principal author, Phil Angelides, the Angelides Report, that covers aspects of the last 30 years in the United States of this subversion or key points in the ruination of the banking system. And it parallels what you wrote about in the way of, here in the U.S., we could call it foreign policy, where the U.S. was in on working with the IMF in London from on high to have Mubarak impose the privatization and everything in Egypt. Do you find in your Arabic language circulation of material, do you find, or just speak about Sweden and Scandinavia, is there more people picking up on beginning to see this bigger picture than getting stuck in the immediate local situation?
There's a certain section of the population, as I said, the people don't believe much more in politicians and mass media because
right.
They have been lied to about the economic crisis. So you have a great number of people looking for a different view of things, and those same people have been hearing what we have been saying, what LaRouche has been saying about the coming financial disintegration of the system. And now they say, well, that's fine. you know, we now understand that you were right on the financial disintegration of the system. But now the question is, are they ready to take the solution?
Okay.
So we are having a fight now here. Like in Sweden, we are making the whole discussion about the Glass-Steagall and even the so-called Angelides report more known here for the public, both directly through our own intervention with leaflets, with our website, with our organizing in the streets, but also through contacting both members of parliament and also people in the mass media. There are interesting people in the media who want to see a different or say different things than what people are used to, because they are worried that their credibility is now on this, you know, at stake. So this is one interesting opening we are, you know, seeing here, although it needs to be expanded. But also in Southwest Asia and North Africa, we have had for many years deep respect for LaRouche's ideas and analysis, but we are trying to bring these ideas concretely to people, especially young people. And, of course, we are doing Arabic versions of the videos we the LaRouche Youth Movement are producing in LaRouche Pack, and trying to find ways to make sure that young people especially, but also there are a certain section of the old generation, like in Egypt, which we know, who still believe in the idea of that Egypt should be an industrial nation. We should have nuclear power. We should, you know, expand the agriculture throughout the desert, make the desert green. They still believe in these possibilities and, you know, trying to intervene through that. But the problem is, unless they see an opening from the United States and from Europe, from, for example, Germany, France, that there is a shift in their policy away from this free trade IMF policy into something similar to what LaRouche has been proposing, they think that they by themselves won't be able to do this in spite of all their, you know, good intentions and what they want to present locally. So the problem comes from the global system, and the solution has to also come from the global. Our work, I mean, to make our ideas and LaRouche's ideas known is proceeding, you know, very fast. But what is needed is a shift in the policy. And therefore, we, like here in Sweden and even like in Denmark, we have had reports that people in parliament, people in the media or in the government, they are ready to listen, but they still have to, you know, take the step to say, this is the right policy. This is what we're going to do to save civilization, to save our society. So we fighting to get to that point where people say, that's the right policy. We're going to do it.
Right. Marcia, yes, go ahead, Larry, please.
I have one question for Hussein. Hussein, in your article, in your interview, you discussed this period around 1982, where there was discussion with representatives from Lyndon LaRouche with people in Egypt, and there was an agreement on an aggressive development program in nuclear energy and irrigation and food production. So what this is at the beginning now of Mubarak coming into office after the assassination of Sadat, and then this is very quickly reversed. Could you tell us more about how this process worked in this change in policy in Egypt?
I mean, there was a direct intervention, a personal intervention by people like Henry Kissinger to, for example, prevent Lyndon LaRouche from presenting these ideas at a conference which was supposed to be organized in Egypt. And, you know, obviously there are other things happening, threats against the government of Egypt, which we yet don't know about. But they might, you know, in the future discover documents where directly people were being threatened in Egypt or through their agents not to work with Lyndon LaRouche, to abandon these policies. Like Kissinger was saying, don't grow food. We will give you free food exported from the United States, produced by American farmers. You don't have to burden your farmers with producing food. You will get that food. So you don't have to have development. You should reduce the population and so on and so forth. So there was with that came, and also with the threats came the corruption aspect of the leadership in Egypt. through the introduction of this whole massive privatization policies. But there are always, like we witnessed after Lyndon LaRouche was in Abu Dhabi, for example, he spoke at the Zayed Center, both on the financial crisis, that was in 2002, but also on the ideas to green the desert, that these nations in the Gulf, instead of focusing on opening financial markets, becoming part of the British offshore banking system, that they should use all their resources and credit to build industries, nuclear power, water desalination, to become agro-industrial nations instead of, you know, what we have seen now in Dubai, both real estate speculation and financial speculation centers, which are going bankrupt. But I know personally that these people in the United Arab Emirates threatened. They're threatened by people in high position in the United States, in Britain, and even in other English-speaking nations, that messages were sent to people in the Zayed Center or even people in government that not to listen to Lyndon LaRouche. And then you had agents of the Saudi system, like Jamal Khashoggi, the son of the famous arms dealer, Adnan right. Khashoggi. He wrote publicly in newspapers threatening Arab countries not to work with Lyndon LaRouche. And at the time, this Khashoggi, he was the, an advisor or secretary of the Saudi former intelligence minister, and who was working as ambassador in London. So you have these kinds of operations to both threaten nations not to work with LaRouche and to change these policies, but also corrupting these leaders in order to go with the British free trade IMF policies. So there are direct interventions. There have been direct interventions against LaRouche's policies and ideas in these countries. But as I said, the authority of the British, that's the good news. The British Empire is collapsing. It's going bankrupt. And the people no longer accept the authority either of Europe or the United States. Because there was this interesting case where, Tunisia, the foreign minister of Tunisia, freaked out yesterday because the European Union offered Tunisia as immediate aid $17 million or 17 million euros. This is a joke.
Right.
And the guy was saying, did I hear wrong? Was it 17 million or 17 billion? And they told him, no, it's 17 million.
Yes, it's tip, right?
And the guy was saying, are they crazy? I don't know why he's surprised, but the problem...
Well, that was in public.
Europe is bankrupt. Now, this is a problem because people in Southwest Asia and Africa, they think Europe and the United States are rich countries. They haven't yet gotten the news that Europe is bankrupt, the United States is bankrupt. And this is what you have, the situation. So the credibility of Europe and the authority of Europe, or the British system, let's say, not the nations of Europe, but the British Empire's authority, is now downgraded, going bankrupt. The problem is that will nations follow with it down, or will they rise and change course and change the policy to survive? This is what the real question today is.
Well, that's a perfect place. I'm mindful that you may have to leave, but that is the question of the era and of the moment, of the hour, that we want people to, that people must act. You mentioned nations. It's to every individual citizen. So I want to thank you for your time, Hussein. I'm not asking you to get off, but I'm respectful that you have other obligations.
Thanks. I will be online in case you have further questions.
Okay. And, Larry, do you want to pick up on that kind of thing in the sense that you have been, Lyndon LaRouche himself, Helga LaRouche, others have been back and forth meeting with people in Sudan for decades, and you happen to be there recently, and you also make the point that LaRouche's ideas are well known there, and this is it for what kind of future we're going to have. Do you want to pick up on that?
Well, the point that Hussein was making on the reality now asserting itself This is in the process, but a lot of people in Africa are going to be waking up to this reality, as Hussein was saying, that there is nothing that's going to come out of the West that's going to make any effort to change the economic conditions in Africa. For example, as people may know, following this referendum for southern Sudan, they are going to be an independent country on July 9th, and it is the conditions there economically are some of the worst in the world and some of the worst conditions in all of Africa, and there's still people there who are deluding themselves that they're going to get some assistance from the West. And, of course, we know they weren't because of this crushing economic collapse, but I've also been told by people familiar with the U.S. government that it's clear there's not going to be any aid to southern Sudan, and people there are already facing a severe food shortage. They cannot feed the people who live there. And when you start discussing the question of food shortages, you really get to a very interesting point that you can question to yourself, and because you can question, well, why is that happening? Because one thing we know is human beings know how to grow food. And we found ways to grow it more efficiently generation after generation for thousands of years. And Africans know how to grow food. They're human beings too. So the question is, why are we having these food deficits? And Hussein went through in the order of 20 million metric tons in North Africa and Egypt. Why? And this is the question you have to ask, because we could grow the food. Therefore, if you're not familiar in detail with these policies, at least you might bring up the hypothesis that somebody's doing this intentionally, because there is no reason for it. And then you get into the kind of policies that have been governing the West since the 1970s with this infamous Kissinger Memorandum, National Security Study Memorandum 200, and the creation of organizations like the World Trade Association, where the intention is to deprive people from a policy imposed on them not to grow food to feed their population. And the only people who succeed usually in growing food and not having to import food are countries that actually violate that policy. So therefore, what you're dealing with is you're dealing with a global food shortage. People who are familiar with Africa know very clearly that we're going to see many more upsurges in Africa. This is not the end, because the food crisis is so pervasive throughout the continent and the Middle East. So this is the beginning, not the end. And the question is, why? Why are we suffering these kind of food shortages? And you have to then begin to think about the question of evil, that there is an actual policy intention to deprive countries of being food self-sufficient. And I think this points to the question that Mr. Lush has been extensively writing about in the last several months, is this question of that the British Empire today is a continuation of the Roman Empire. And the conception of empire is to destroy people, is to prevent them from being and functioning and living like human beings, and empires to destroy nations so they cannot actually function as sovereign nations, states that can fulfill the aspirations and needs of the people. I think these questions have to be looked at, because there's no other way of explaining this crisis. It is not, as Angelides said in his report, it was not a perfect storm, it was not God-given, it was deliberate to take down the U.S. financial system. And what's happening in Africa throughout the world is also deliberate creation of food shortages.
Right. One thing the two of you, Hussein and Larry, you bring to my mind, that in 1974, when this Kissinger Secretary of State study memorandum, I think it was December 1974, was written, that nations such as Egypt and 13 or 15 nations identified around the world should not be allowed to develop and expand their population because it would be considered a threat to the empire of the London and the U.S. and so forth. That a few months earlier was one of the first world food conferences held in Rome, the Rome Food Conference, where Henry Kissinger personally represented the U.S., and he bumped aside then-Secretary of Agriculture Earl Butz. He had some scandal he worked up. And Kissinger personally, as the face of evil, said, "Trust us, we are," he cried crocodile tears, "we're concerned about people in the world who don't have enough food. So trust us, we will now take care of you. We will decide, we will make sure you have enough food." So I'm just underscoring the face of evil at the time, Henry Kissinger in 1974. But one thing on the either one of you, but Hussein, the kinds of plans originally, like in the 60s, the idea of the Aswan Dam, the idea of going in with many nuclear plants along the Mediterranean or the Red Sea to desalinate. Could you just say more a bit about this to make it clear for our listeners how concrete the intentions were on the side of humanity?
Yeah, well, you had, as it's still the case, because the policy where it originates from, I mean, in the 60s, you had the, I mean, even the 50s, the idea for using nuclear power, for example, to desalinate the water and create economic development in Southwest Asia was one of the policies of President Eisenhower. It's called the Atoms for Peace. And, you know, when the United States presents such a policy, people in the region would react positively, and they say, great, then we can work together on these things. So there was, you know, after the World War period, you had this enormous optimism, and when these nations became free from British colonialism, all kinds of plans were flourishing. I mean, some of these plans and ideas were already presented by Franklin Roosevelt, others by national leaders in the region. So, I mean, concerning Egypt, you had both the nuclear power development to desalinate seawater and create new industries, because the Egyptians' idea was not only to become an agricultural society. Their idea was to be self-sufficient in agriculture, but their real idea was to become an industrial nation in the region and be at the level of what Europe was in the 60s and 70s. So this was a clear idea that people had. So it needed enormous amount of power. You needed also to expand the water resources, but also, like, as I wrote in the recent EIR, is that you have, like in Egypt, you have a situation where 95% of the people live on only 5% of the land, of the country. So 95% of Egypt is empty. And then you have areas where the population density is more than 1,000 per kilometer, square kilometer. Like you have in Cairo, you can't even walk in certain areas without bumping into other people. But then 95% of Egypt is totally empty. The problem is that they don't have water. So there are all kinds of projects to build new cities to get out of the Nile Valley. They were called the New Nile Valley. Like you had the diverting water from the Aswan Dam to the desert to the west, where today we have the Toshki project. Unfortunately, that project failed because it was stolen by Saudi businessmen who were growing, fruit and other things to be shipped and exported to Saudi Arabia and other countries instead of growing food for the Egyptians. So that was one great project. People still say we have to reclaim that project. There are other projects to move water to the Sinai desert and building new cities, new agro-industrial centers there. You have the project which existed for decades of filling the Qattara Depression, which is a lower region of Egypt, much lower than the sea level, and that seawater would be transferred through channels and using hydroelectric power generation, and then use that power to desalinate seawater. Now, there are other Egyptians who say, no, we should not use salt water to fill the Qattara Depression. We can use water which remains from the Nile before joining the sea, but also we can desalinate seawater and have fresh water and build new cities and agricultural centers around the Qatar Depression and so on and so forth. Egypt was supposed to have a bidding for nuclear power plants in December. It didn't work because of the political situation, but they had plans to, open for bidding, like the Russians were interested and other countries were, South Korea were interested of building nuclear power plants in Egypt, that they will be completed in 2020. So you have a massive number of ideas and projects which are presented through the decades. The problem is that they have either been sabotaged or Egypt was prevented from doing these, or because, you know, you need technology, you need credit and so forth, and they have been denied that. So the same thing goes for every other country in the region. They have had great ideas. A lot of them originated with Franklin Roosevelt, President Franklin Roosevelt, but others were, you know, created by national leaders like Jamal Abdel Nasser and others. And there are people who still believe in these projects. I mean, in Egypt, for example, you listen to people, they say, of course we will build these things. So that's and I think the video which was produced by LaRouche-PAC, the LaRouche youth, was presented by Aaron Halevi 2 days ago, is a fantastic overview of the kinds of projects which are possible, not only for growing food, but also changing the whole biosphere to make it more friendly to life, or yes, to make the desert areas more friendly to life and human life.
Yeah, people should watch that. The Hope for Africa was released February 18. The Hope for Africa, it's on LaRouchePAC.com. And I think, you know, there's a picture of it, of the Nile, and the mission for a breadbasket mission of the Nile, as they call it. But really, as you say, because of high technology, industrialization, and so forth. And with that, I wonder if either one of you, Larry, you're just back from Sudan, you were in Darfur, and Hussein, you have visited in the Marawi Dam and so forth. Would you say something about the same thing regarding Sudan?
Well, you see, Sudan's a very clear case, again, of the failure to really continue the policy of Franklin Roosevelt. Because if the United States and the West had a Roosevelt policy over the last several decades, you have the capability in Sudan, and this is well known and numerous studies have been written, to develop and grow enough food to feed all of Africa. And the potential has been there, and it's a known potential in terms of arable land. The land, it's not like a desert land. Sort of a clay desert land, which responds very well to water. And so the question then you have to, again, ask yourself is, well, why haven't we done this? If we could feed over 1 billion people using the Sudan breadbasket, why haven't we done it? And what policy have we had that's been substituted for that? And you look at the fact that instead of actually generating the credits for investment in infrastructure, primarily water and power to grow food, the policy coming out of the United States has been a policy to try to destabilize Sudan instead of actually trying to develop the country. So that any idea of a Roosevelt, even Eisenhower, even Kennedy approach to developing these nations in Africa using the most advanced science and technological capabilities has been essentially completely discarded, and you have a different policy, one represented by this Kissinger policy as we saw in Egypt, and it's still operating in Sudan today. We did have the opportunity, my wife and I, to visit three internally displaced people's camps outside of El Fasher in North Darfur, and people there live absolutely terribly. They have to stand on line to fill up jugs of water. They have to go to a food depot to get food. There is the housing, which you really can't call it housing. It's still mud huts, straw huts, simple brick huts. And people, you're talking about 1.8 million people live in this condition in camps throughout all of Darfur. But then the really difficult question to conceptualize is that these people live better than other people do in Sudan and other parts of Africa. You have people who don't even have daily access to water. They don't have daily access to food. And the conditions throughout all of Africa, to a large extent, and if you take Sudan, this area of Darfur, which is the western part of the country, the whole area, bordering on Chad, bordering on Central African Republic, bordering on Libya, this whole area is underdeveloped. So if the people leave the camps, they have nowhere, in many cases, nowhere better to go. So if you don't have a commitment to make a major transformation of the entire region, the entire an intervention into the Sahel Desert, into the Sahara Desert, if you're not going to make that intervention, you're probably not going to change very much, because you're not, you're dealing with one isolated little region. You're dealing with the conditions in Africa, which could be changed if we actually made the intention to apply our full scientific and technological capability. And our policy from the West, led by the United States and the British, has not only been not to carry out the development, but it's actually carry out policy of genocide. People are dying that don't have to die. People are living one level above animal, which is not why we were put on this earth, is to live like animals. People should be living like human beings, and we are being deprived of that potential. Of millions of human beings are not allowed to live like human beings because of these policies, of which there's not an objective problem. There's only a subjective policy decision not to develop this area.
Yeah, you may want to personify this, Larry, in the sense that as we've Hussein and we've talked about Kissinger, we're talking about the Obama gang that was put in there for these London genocide policies. I mentioned Susan Rice, who's actively Obama's ambassador to the UN, who's doing everything to perpetrate this evil. If you want to say something about that.
Well, it's the case is, you know, right now, there's a grouping in the United States, Hillary Clinton is part of it, that would like to move forward and develop more positive relations with Sudan. That doesn't make up for the mistakes of the past, but you have to move forward. And there's a grouping in Sudan, in the Khartoum government, people in the foreign ministry office, in the government, et cetera, who also want to move in this direction to try to establish more normal relations with the United States. And while that is going on, you have the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice, who has a clear policy to overthrow the government in Khartoum. That rather than develop the country and unite now two separate countries, have to work together, North and South Sudan, the people associated with Susan Rice and herself are still trying to fragment the country even more, to divide it up into more sections. Maybe it will be a Darfur section of the country. Maybe it will be a Blue Nile section of the country. And what's really needed now, and what we discussed when we were in Khartoum, is that the North and the South need each other. And they're actually a common people, despite the fact that everybody tries to divide them up between Arab and African and Christian and Muslim. They're one people. And they've lived together for a long time. And it's very unfortunate that they've now been separated. But they can have a common mission with each other to develop the entire country for the benefit of both North and South Sudan. So sort of a principle of the Treaty of Westphalia, the benefit of the other is a benefit to thyself. And it has to center around the key questions of water, power, and increased food production. And this is something that will benefit all of Sudan and provide a basis of post-referendum agreements. Again, July 9th, Southern Sudan will become a separate country. How do these two countries live together? Is there a positive purpose to their unity? Well, there is. And that should be centered around exactly bringing in these projects for water, power, and increased food production. There's a group of people in the U.S. and in Britain, led by Susan Rice, who want to prevent that. And then, of course, you have the fact that the economic crisis, which is not caused by Africa, even though there's hyperinflation, price increases in food in Khartoum and elsewhere, the crisis is caused in the United States by the Federal Reserve and exactly the people that Phil Benzelides has identified in his report have taken over the U.S. banking system with a shadow banking system. And so until we in the United States deal with that problem, it's going to be difficult for any country around the world to make the breakthroughs that are necessary. But nevertheless, they have to move in this direction while we're trying to win the fight in the United States and in Western Europe for a total change in economic policy, as LaRouche has discussed.
Yes, we have 5 minutes left. I want to add right now and then put it back to you, gentlemen. Two things I want everyone to know, though. March 10th, people should keep that in mind for an international webcast by Lyndon LaRouche. It will be based out of the Washington, D.C. area. And that's a Thursday, not a Saturday, March 10th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on his Political Action Committee website, LaRouchePAC.com. And also, I want to point out that Mr. LaRouche's last January 22nd webcast on the State of the Union, the beginning of the year, the right in the midst of these historic shifts, Mr. LaRouche gave a State of the Union evaluation of the strategic situation. And that has been printed in hard copy by LaRouche Political Action Committee, which needs everyone involved in circulating. It's 40 pages. It has an overview of the North American Water and Power Alliance. It has questions and answers. And really, I'm pointing that out, not obviously for not just something to read up or review, but to distribute everywhere. There's an operation, I think something like 15 out of the 50 states have had very active LaRouche Political Action Committee teams visiting the legislatures and legislators and other leaders in those states of the country. And that's where, so there's no scenario like Wisconsin, Ohio, New Jersey, some other state. We are making an intervention with impossibly small resources, so everyone should contribute financially and to carry this through. So that said, though, let me turn back. I think Hussein may still be able to be on with this. Are you still there, Hussein?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Good, because in the remaining minutes, if you want to comment further, either about the geographic part of the world that you often deal with or at large, to reiterate some of the points, please do.
Yeah, sure. I think, as Helga Tseplarouche said recently on her statement on the revolt in Egypt, that we are witnessing a drama. You know, we are not yet in a tragedy. You know, the tragedy comes from the corruption of the culture. And Larry was asking why these projects were not done. Why aren't we not feeding people? Because, like, as in every case, everything starts with idea. Your idea of yourself, of human beings and your relationship to other human beings and nature and the universe determines actually your actions. It's like when people say we have too many people on Earth or too many people in Africa and Asia. That's the first step towards a dark age because that determines your action or inaction to develop the lives of human beings. If you say there are limited resources on Earth or in the world, then you are also taking a decision not to develop the resources which are not yet discovered. And therefore, you will accept the policy of genocide, but in a nice, you know, wrapped in a nice thing about environmentalism and so on. So the ideas we believe in determine how we act. And that's very important because that's where the corruption starts. But also, I mean, as I said, we are in a drama and we have reached the punctum saliens. Decisions and actions we take today, they will determine history for many generations forward. And I think people have to take a step back from watching the TV news and reading the newspaper reports about what's happening in Egypt, what's happening in this or that country, and think about what are the ideas governing our behavior today, wherever we are in the world. They might be ideological ideas of this environmentalist nonsense or the free market, or liberalism, or religious fanaticism. Because if people accept that poverty is the will of God, then they will not be able to solve their problems. And the same thing if you say we cannot intervene in the markets. And with Glass-Steagall, you are also taking a decision not to change, to solve the economic problems. So that's where the issue lies. What kind of ideas are governing our behavior and the civilization we have today? And this is what people really have to think about instead of watching the news.
I thank you very much for bringing that up, because you remind us of a good antidote to slipping in any way, to not thinking about what the significance of ideas. The LaRouche Political Action Committee also has something called a cautionary tale, a short short video feature about the diseases you'll get if you watch too much of the media that dish out such things as you were describing. Explanations that it's just lack of water or poverty and so forth. And so all the diseases you might get, including ones like pelvic headache, that's one, isn't it, are described in a funny way. And I think that, Hussein, you must have really seen some doozies when it comes to the media, you know, discussions whether Twitter and social networking is what is behind the Egyptian uprising, or whether on the right-wing so-called media, there's blame for the State Department collaborating with Google as behind what happened in Egypt and Tunisia. But enough of that. This we want to end on the higher note, as you described, that if citizens respond and nations respond and we do our job here in the United States, this isn't a tragedy. This is an opportunity. And I thank you, Hussein Haskari, Larry Freeman. And this will be the conclusion of February 19th, the LaRouche Show. This is Marcia Mary Baker signing off. Don't forget about March 10th, the International LaRouche webcast. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.